was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year.
Oyster Bay, New York, July 4, 10:50 p.m.
While Roman candles and skyrockets blazed in celebration of the nation's political independence, President Theodore Roosevelt stood by the side of telegraph magnate Mackey, watching Superintendent Usher transmit the message.
To Governor Taft, Manila, I open the American Pacific Cable with greetings to you and the people of the Philippines. Theodore Roosevelt.
Shortly, greetings from the Philippine Islands was speeding toward the president over the newly completed 8,300-mile cable. Thereupon, Roosevelt dispatched a message to Mackey, the first to travel round the world via the new line on a westward course. When it was received, Mackey dictated his reply at 5 minutes to midnight. At 12:04:30 a.m., again the key clicked.
This sounds like it. Will you read it, please, Mr. Usher?
To the President, Oyster Bay. I thank you deeply for your message, and I earnestly hope the Pacific Cable, by opening the wide horizon of the Great East, may prove a useful factor to the commerce of the United States. Clarence H. Mackey.
And now, let's see what the time on that will be. 11:55 to 12:04:30.
Around the world in just 9.5 minutes. Say, that's bully. I'm delighted.
19-3, that was the year.
August 4. At about 11 a.m., the Sacred College of Cardinals in conclave for the purpose of electing a new pope. Following the death of Leo XIII, heard Cardinal Caseta, as scrutineer, read the results of the voting.
Cardinal Sarto.
42. We have elected a pontiff.
Your Eminence, do you accept the position as Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church?
If this cup cannot pass from me...
Your Eminence, your answer must be yes or no.
Yes.
After a brief rest, the new pontiff, accompanied by the other cardinals, joined the procession through the winding halls to the window of St. Peter. As Cardinal Macchi opened the doors...
I announce to you with great pleasure that we have elected as Pope the most eminent Reverend Giuseppe Cardinal Sarto, who has taken the name of Pius X.
Hail Pius Pope the
King! Auditorium Nostrum. In nomine Domini. Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus.
Later, Pius X began officially a new era in papal history as he was crowned with a three-crown tiara.
19-3. That was the year...
of the settlement of the Canadian-American dispute over the Alaskan boundary.
The Anglo-Russian Treaty of 1825 fixed certain portions of the boundary between Alaska and Canada as a line parallel to the coast and 10 marine leagues inward. Since 1888, Canada had been advancing the claim that the line should be measured 10 leagues from the westernmost tips of the islands along the coast and not 10 leagues from the coast of the mainland itself, which was the claim of the U.S. Finally, in 1903... under pressure from President Roosevelt, a commission of 6 was appointed by the two governments. Roosevelt had written to Secretary of State Hay,
I don't want the thing pending during a presidential campaign. And moreover, if the English decline to come to an agreement this fall under any pretense, I shall feel that it is simply a matter of bad faith. I think that they ought to be made to understand that I shall probably, if they fail to come to some agreement, bring the matter to the attention of Congress and ask for an appropriation so that we can run the line ourselves.
The American members of the Alaskan Boundary Tribunal.
Secretary of War Elihu Root. Senators Henry Cabot Lodge and George Turner.
The British members.
Baron Elveston, Lord Chief Justice of England, Lieutenant Governor Louis Jetté of Quebec, and Ontario lawyer Alan Bristol Aylesworth.
Lord Elveston was elected president, and from September 3 to October 20, discussions, negotiations, diplomatic insinuations continued. At last, Baron Elveston, siding with the American members, threw the power of the tribunal toward a settlement favoring the U.S., giving to Canada only one of her several claims, access to the sea by the Portland Canal only.
And following the announcement of the decision, said the two Canadian commissioners in a blanket statement,
"We urged our views as strongly as we are able, but we have been compelled to witness the sacrifice of the interests of Canada."
1903. That was the year?
But there occurred a series of events of vast importance to the U.S. Indeed, to the entire world.
November 3.
Panama proclaims her independence from Colombia, declares the formation of the Republic of Panama.
November 6.
The U.S. recognizes the Republic of Panama.
November 18.
In the residence of Secretary of State John Hay, the bearded diplomat sits studying the phrases of an engrossed document. Promptly at 6 p.m.
Come. The Honorable Mr. Bunau Varilla, Minister from the Republic of Panama.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Come in, sir.
Thank you, senor.
Sit down, Mr. Bunau Varilla. Well, we're all ready.
What, senor? Why, you have the document prepared?
In duplicate. You will, of course, want to study it.
If you please, senor.
After perusing the voluminous pages with extreme care, the representative of the Baby Republic turns to John Hay.
I am in complete accord, senor. I will sign.
Good. And here is the pen. Thank you. And now, for the United States.
Oh, senor, you have no idea how happy this has made me, and how happy it will make the people of our newly born country. I congratulate.
And my congratulations to you, Senor Bunau Varilla. I believe we have signed a document of inestimable import to both nations.
The terms of the Hay-Bunau Varilla Treaty gave the U.S. the right to build an Isthmian canal. 10 years later, President Woodrow Wilson touched the button which destroyed the Gamboa Dike, the last obstruction to navigation from Atlantic to Pacific through the Panama Canal.
1903. That was the year
that Orville and Wilbur Wright, navigating a flying machine of their own design, flew 3 miles in the teeth of a 21-mile windstorm at Kitty Hawk, Virginia, landed easily and safely, the first time in the history of the world that man had completed successful aerial flight without the aid of a balloon.
1903. That was the year.
Chicago, Illinois, December 30. Every one of the 1,740 seats of the Iroquois Theater are filled with young people home from colleges and schools for Christmas holidays with their families and friends. The entire audience is convulsed at the annex of comedian Eddie Foy and his company in the musical production Mr. Bluebeard. Gradually, the audience becomes aware of frantic shouts seeping through from backstage. Then, as a signal for the tragic pandemonium which followed, someone sees a piece of flaming muslin floating down onto the stage. A few laugh at the grotesque spectacle of comedian Foy, half-clothed, half-made-up, bearing his infant son in his arms, handing him over the footlights to the orchestra leader. Soon, the entire theater becomes a seething human maelstrom. Terrified stagehands attempt to lower the asbestos safety curtain. It falters and halts halfway down. Wintry breezes from open stage doors fan the flames, and then the lights blink and go out. When the fire chief entered the charred building a half hour later, he found human bodies choking every exit, piled 7 feet high. To his call,
"Is anyone alive in here?"
There was no answer. 588 persons, but a short while before, laughing and applauding in the heights of free Christmas cheer, were carried from the Iroquois Theater, dead.
1903. That was the year
that this pathetic but highly popular ballad was on every tongue.
The preacher said the words that made us one.
master said your work on earth was done. Hear, old girl, the robin sings above you. Hear, old girl, it speaks of how tears are falling as I think of my lost pearl, and my broken heart is calling, calling for you. Hear, old girl.
Hear, old girl, the robin sings. Dear old girl, it speaks of how I love you.
The blinding tears are falling as I think of my